battle with his brothers.
When you get to sort of the other thing, you know, it's this, you know, Noah, beautiful rainbow. I don't know about you, but maybe your kids have the linen, the Noah bed sheets. I don't know if you have those, but I had those, the animals and the ark and the rainbow. They're all very cute. And then you think it's such a cute story with animals and rainbows. You don't realize that, you know, millions of people died in this cataclysmic flood. It's a much scarier story when you see it as adults. Similarly, the story of Yosef also has that quality. When we're kids, it's all very cute. There was this guy Yosef, and he had this beautiful coat, and again, multicolored coat. And then you see in musicals like Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat, the brothers get together, they play this practical joke on them, right? They throw him in this pit, and then Joseph plays a practical joke on them, and he dresses up, and he doesn't reveal himself for a long time, and then he reveals himself, and everybody lives happily ever after. And they all go to Mitzrayim, they have a lot of food. And that's kind of the story you read when you're this is the story you read when you're in second grade. And then, like, if you're an adult, and you actually reread the story, sometimes it sort of challenges your second grade notions, if you even bother getting that far. Oftentimes we just read it and just reconfirms our second grade notions, and we read it over and over and over again, but we never actually read it as adults. It's kind of funny, you know, when we do math, you know, you do math in second grade, but then you come back to it and, you know, you get into algebra and you get into geometry. And somehow, so much, it doesn't always work like that, especially for men. For women, it does more, but for the men, that we tend to get involved in Mishnah and Gemara, and we leave so much behind in fourth grade, so we kind of can easily get stuck in that sort of fourth grade apprehension of so much. But as an adult, when you think about the Yosef story, it's really pretty scary. I mean, here these guys were. What would you feel like if you got kidnapped one day, thrown into a pit, almost killed, stripped naked, sold off, you know, by the Ishmaelim into some unknown future as a slave in Egypt? This is not very pretty. And your whole life is changed as a result. You have no idea what's going on. This is a very traumatic event, to put it mildly. And the question is, at the very end of the story, what happens to the family? Do the brothers and Yosef ever sort of put their relationship back together, put Humpty Dumpty back together again? The relationship may not ever have been great, but do they somehow ever reconcile? Is there a happy ending at the end of the story when it comes to Yosef and his brothers, or is there just some sort of cold detente, and that's it? And the Torah doesn't explicitly tell you the answer to this, but there are a number of intriguing clues, and I'd like to explore them with you tonight to see what we make of them, and also ask ourselves what difference it makes for us. How does that affect us in our lives, as well as Jewish history? Maybe we'll begin with, strangely enough, a little piece from Shmos, which isn't going to seem like it has anything to do with anything, but I think by the end of tonight we'll see what it does. The very beginning of Shmos, you're all familiar with this, Perak Aleph, Pasuk Ches, but Yaakov Melech Chodesh al Mitzrayim, Asher Lo Yada Et Yosef. So a new king comes upon Egypt who doesn't know anything about Yosef. It's strange, of course, that the king, a new pharaoh that wouldn't know about Yosef, the generation after Yosef. Yosef was the most famous guy around. He didn't know about Yosef, so Chazal are bothered by this. And you're familiar with the Chazal that say that as there's a machlokas and the Gemara as to what the nature of this king's lack of knowledge of Yosef really is. Some say Rav and Shmuel, some say that he really didn't know who Yosef was. The other says that he knew who Yosef was, but made himself forget Yosef, made himself as if he didn't know who Yosef was. But the question still remains the same. Even if he knew who Yosef was, why would he want to make himself as if he didn't know Yosef? Yosef was such a good guy. He saved everyone. He saved Egypt. Everyone was so happy with Yosef. But in any case, here's this king, this new king who doesn't know anything about Yosef. But Yomer Alamon, he says to his people, Hine Ambnei Yisrael Rava Batsumi Menu. These Jews, they're greater than we are. Haven is chakmalo, ten year be, vayati krena mechamav and asaf kam was, and edu benil chambanu ba'alam in ha'aret. Let's deal wisely with them, lest they multiply even further. And when war comes, they'll add themselves to our enemies and war against us and force us out of the land, or they'll force themselves out of the land. If you look carefully at that pasuk, you'll find a couple sort of subterranean allusions to Yosef from this king who supposedly forgot about him. Anyone find them? Let's start there. Right? Let's deal wisely with them. What trait was Yosef known for most during his lifetime? What trait did Pharaoh, the previous Pharaoh, view Yosef as having? He was a chacham. After God has made clear to you all of this, there's no one who's as smart as you. So Yosef was the quintessential smart guy in the eyes of Pharaoh. And all of a sudden Pharaoh says, this new Pharaoh, well, let's deal smartly with these Jews. That's Yosef's midah. Not only that, can you find a subtle allusion to Yosef's name in that pasuk? Anybody? Nosaf. They will add themselves against their enemies. Just so happens that Nosaf, of course, is the same shoresh as Yosef. Yosef can mean to add, and Nosaf here is to add. So here's, and there's another allusion which we'll get to by the end of tonight, buried in here as well to Yosef. There's three different allusions to Yosef's name in one pasuk in this declaration from a king who supposedly doesn't remember Yosef, or doesn't know anything about Yosef, or made himself as if he didn't know about Yosef. So for a king who's forgetting Yosef, he seems to remember him quite well. Mm-hmm. So what's the deal here? Why is this king remembering Yosef? And what does this have to do with this decree of slavery, which is emerging and devolving upon the Jewish people as a result of the words of this king? Right? Yosef's such a good guy. What's happening here with these memories of Yosef that are seeping into the king's language? So let's keep that in the back of our minds and just come back to this question about Yosef and the brothers. Did they ever reconcile? Let me begin by asking you this. Do you think they could have ever reconciled? In other words, is reconciliation possible? Let's even start with that. In other words, and let's take this out of the realm of Yosef for a moment into your own life. If something like this happened to you, right, something this bad happened to you, would it be possible to ever make up with the perpetrators of this? Right? You're somebody in your family, siblings, right? One day they did something at this level, right? Something at the level of jumping you, throwing you into a pit, kidnapping you, almost killing you, completely altering the course of your life, the trajectory of your life, selling you as a slave. It's almost impossible to imagine this kind of thing. Even the notion of sold into a slave, you know, in 21st century America, it's very difficult to get our hands around what that means. Just actually, a couple of hours ago, I was working with my daughter on a term paper that she was doing on the Industrial Revolution. So she had to talk about the social effects of the Industrial Revolution and the impact that it had on family life in England in the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So she's writing a report, and she's talking about various different effects of the Industrial Revolution. She's talking about how families didn't have time to spend with each other because they were working so hard, and they were working in the factories, and it was so long and so late at night and for so little pay that families didn't get a chance to see each other at all, and family life was sort of disintegrating because everyone was working so hard that by the time everyone got home, they just, you know, there was no time to even breathe. But when you actually look at the primary document and examine what was really happening in the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, you look at things like the Sadler Report, which was issued by a British MP, who did a report on factory conditions, what was happening in factories in the early part of the Industrial Revolution and child labor. You'll actually notice that if you look at the kids who were interviewed in the Sadler Report, the kids were actually kidnapped from their families, were basically indentured servants for 6 years or longer, for as little as 15 shillings. The mother gets 15 shillings, the kid is gone for 6 years. We're not talking about coming home on weekends. We're not talking about coming home at 10 at night. We're talking about gone. Not only gone, but beaten, right? Work days, which were 19 hours long, right? 19-hour-long work days, where, I mean, it actually reminds you of Paro, you know, the amount. At first there was a clock, right? And then the kids begged that they shouldn't be held to the clock because there was no way they could finish their quotas and they would be beaten. So they sort of voluntarily, quote, worked for 19 hours. And then the kid who was interviewed, who went through 3 years of this, was then forced to be the overseer of other kids and then in turn beat those kids because he had to, because otherwise he would be killed or something close to that. And it was literally slavery. So why do I bring this in? Because if you think about it, you know, I think my daughter had seen that. She had skimmed over that. But at first, as she's writing the report, the only thing that can really go into her brain is, oh, it was really bad. They barely got to see each other. They got home late at night. This is so far removed from your experience that it's just not comprehensible. It just sort of washes off of you as if it's plastic or something. To be able to internalize what you're talking about here, it's a completely different world. So too with slavery, to wrap your minds around the trauma of what it means to be sold as a slave, to leave your family behind, that's really rough. So something like that, at that level, it's almost difficult to imagine what you could even go through that bad. But if something that bad happened to you at the hands of your siblings, right, could you imagine that reconciliation would be possible, or is reconciliation simply a pipe dream that's absolutely not possible under any circumstances? So quick vote. Everyone who believes that reconciliation is possible, right? Maybe not easy, but possible, right? Raise your hand. You believe reconciliation is possible. Okay. All those who believe that reconciliation is really not possible, it's a pipe dream, raise your hand if you believe reconciliation is not possible. Okay. So we're split about 50-50 here, right? Between those who believe that reconciliation is possible but difficult and those who believe that it's actually impossible. So a little while back, I was in Akron, Ohio, and happened to be Parshas Vayechi, and I was talking about this, and for some reason, the Federation Akron decided that I knew how to talk to kids, so, very young kids. So they brought in these second graders and these third graders and these fourth graders, and I was sort of did Parsha with these kids. So I sort of asked them this question. I said, if something like this bad happened to you with your kids, with your family, do you think that you would ever be able to get over this or not? So interestingly enough, the kids voted consistently, right? Every grade. I did this. It was like a real experiment with controls. It was great because I had all these different classes. I could do it over and over again. And over and over again, the kids consistently voted by about 2-1 that it was possible to get over this, that you could reconcile, that you could put everything back together again. Now that night, I spoke to the parents of these kids. And I said, I was chatting with the kids this morning, and I was asking this question. Before I tell you what they said, I want to ask you what you guys think. Right? Do you think it's possible to really get over this? So that would happen. Parents voted 2-1 in the opposite direction. Right? That it was impossible to reconcile. So I said, well, you'll never guess what your kids say. Right? Because all of your kids are telling me 2-1 that it is possible to reconcile. So how do you understand the difference between what you guys believe, what your kids believe? You think you're so much smarter than your kids, right? Now really, the truth is parents aren't so much smarter than their kids, right? And it was in raw brain power, kids are pretty smart too. What really is the difference between adults and children? Really life experience, right? With the leg up or the leg down, as it were, that we have on everyone else, is that we have life experience. And life experience either enlightens us or makes us jaded, but the bottom line is, it influences us. To me, the discrepancy between what the adults believe and what the kids believe is explainable in terms of life experience, which means that the kids, not viewing this through life experience, but only viewing it as a theoretical model, yes, you can imagine reconciliation. Reconciliation, theoretically, you can construct some sort of model in your head for what reconciliation would look like. But the way adults react to that question is they immediately go to their life experience, to some sort of event that happened in their family, and they go, no. right? Because it didn't happen, right? You saw this, and just somehow you can never really put it back together. You just can't put Humpty Dumpty back together that way. So the answer is, who's right? The answer is, they're both sort of right. It depends what you mean by right. In other words, it's true, the kids are right, that theoretically you can construct the model. But the adults are also right that life experiences teaches you that it usually doesn't work, right? That it's very, very hard, that the model is possible, but it's very, very hard to achieve. However, it seems like it's achievable. It's not a foregone conclusion that it's unachievable. So the question I want to ask tonight is, if Yosef and his brothers were to reconcile, what would have to happen for them to reconcile? What is the theoretical model? And then, in actuality, did the theoretical model work or did it not work? Did they ever really reconcile or not? So that's what we're going to look at. So with no further ado, let's kind of jump in and discuss this. L'chaim, everyone. Okay. Let's talk about candidates for reconciliation. You all know the Yosef story, right? Yosef plays dress up with his brothers and reveals himself. And so when would you say the very first possible moment where you could imagine that you could hold up and say, this is a possible moment of reconciliation between Yosef and the brothers, when would this be? Let me give you a candidate for reconciliation. You tell me if you think this candidate makes the grade or not. When's the first possible moment you can imagine them reconciling? Anyone? Okay, that's certainly possible, but I can think of one even before that moment. We'll get to that in a moment. She was talking about when Yehuda makes the speech to Yosef. Maybe that works. We'll discuss that in a moment, but I just want to go back earlier chronologically. Can anyone think of a point even before that that you might argue is a possible point of reconciliation? What's that? Okay, maybe Yosef forgives them because he sees that God, you know, that through them something good happened. Could be. Any evidence for that in the text? That just,
he
says something very close to that, doesn't he? When did he say something very close to that? Anyone remember? Correct. Right when he reveals himself to the brothers, the very first time he reveals himself, the very first words out of his mouth are, "Va'ata al zichar beinechem ki mechartam afihena." Now don't be upset that you sold me here. Kilu mechia shafani elagim beinechem. God did this to provide for you. So, you know, I'm helping you. So this isn't very gracious. Maybe that's a moment of reconciliation. What about even before this? Is there an even earlier moment that you might imagine as a moment of reconciliation?
Yosef actually sees them coming down for food. He recognizes, them. They don't recognize him. It could have been a moment. I mean, that could have been the earliest.
Okay, do we have any evidence? Anything that happens that actually might be enough to put the past behind them? Think about that encounter. What happens during that encounter that actually, if you were Yosef, might just be enough to make you put your past behind them? Remember what happens? He sees his brothers coming. They don't recognize him. He recognizes them. Yosef begins to speak harshly to them. He tells them he doesn't believe them. He tells them they're spies. They say, no, we're not spies. We've got this brother at home. Yosef says, I demand to see your brother at home. I'm taking you all as slaves. And then he says, you know what? Forget it. I'll let you all go, but I'm taking one as slave. I'm taking one of you as a slave, right? It's going to be Shimon, right? Now, at that point, the brothers start talking among themselves. And what do they say? Now, they're talking in Hebrew without realizing that Yosef, disguised Yosef, understands Hebrew. So they don't know that their conversation is overheard by Yosef. What do they say? Anyone remember? They say, "Avala sheinima nasnu." We are guilty. Right? We are guilty when we heard his pain. Right? When he was pleading for us, below shamanu, and we didn't listen. All came by lingwasharazo. Right? That's why this terrible thing happened to us. Right? So now, if you're Yosef and you're listening, which Yosef was listening, right? So maybe that's enough, right? Maybe that's a moment of reconciliation. So let's just take a quick vote on each of these moments, okay? You're Yosef, okay, and I'm asking you this question. You've just heard your brothers talk among themselves. They don't know you're listening, right? They're saying among themselves, oh my gosh, look at what's happening to us. Shimon has been taken as a slave, right? It's all because we didn't listen to Yosef's cries at the pit, right? We must be guilty, God's taking it out on us. At this moment, is that enough to sort of completely put the past behind you? Let me also describe to you what I mean by reconciliation. I don't mean smiling in the hallway, right, and getting along at Thanksgiving dinner, right? I mean actually putting the relationship back together. Literally no hard feelings, right? I was letting go, complete, right, real forgiveness and rehabilitation of the relationship that we really have laid to rest the past. So is this declaration that Yosef's overhearing, is this enough for Yosef to be able to put the past behind him in this kind of way? Everyone who says no, raise your hands. Okay, I would agree with you, no. Why no? Why is this not enough? Anybody?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Too little, too late.
Too little, too late. Okay, yeah, what do you say?
Maybe they're using the action also to heal, they're actually,
Like, maybe they'll talk about the fact that they feel bad, but, like, if they'll act on it, then, like, you'll realize that they're really, they should feel
it. Okay, so maybe an action's missing. Is it like the talk is cheap? Right? Do they really believe this? Are they willing to put their money where their mouth is? Are they acting this way? Maybe that's what we're looking for.
I think it's much worse than that. I think that they are giving him an in, and he's deliberately not taking it. The fact that he doesn't take it,
the fact that who doesn't take it?
The Seth doesn't take the opportunity. He has to see them bow down. He has to see the dreams fulfilled. He has to put the brothers through so much pain. That increases the anger, increases the separation between them. And even if there was a point at this point, if he doesn't come in now, everything thereafter just exacerbates the situation.
Okay, so you're saying that Yosef had this moment where he could have reconciled now, but chose not to. Let me ask you this question. If you were Yosef, would that be enough for you, overhearing what they're saying? I need to put you on the spot. I'm only asking you all. Right?
I think that, I'd have to be a very mature individual. I think it would be because I've reached my pinnacle. I've reached the point. Do I really have to see them bow down?
Hold on a second.
I have to see my father come and bow down and didn't mean to?
Okay, well, hold on for a second. You're making an assumption which I'm not willing to make right now. Okay, the assumption you're making is that the reason why Yosef is keeping the charade up is because he wants the dreams realized.
Mm-hmm.
I actually don't believe that personally. I know there are Rishonim that say that, right? The Ramban makes that argument that that's why the brothers did that. I'm not so convinced. There are others who argue. I'm not so sure that I would buy that. But I, another possible alternative, Rabbi Yoel ben Nun makes this argument in Megadim, right, is that what's keeping Yosef going is a fear that he has, right? Now, if you're Yosef, what fear do you have? Here you go, you were discriminated against, the children of Leah kicked you out of the family, you're the child of Rachel. All of a sudden, everyone shows up the door, you see your brothers, except there's only one problem, which is? One's gone. It's not there. In your heart of hearts, what are you thinking now? What are you worried about now? What the heck happened to him? Did the same thing happen to him as happened to me? I mean, he's terribly fearful. If you think about Yosef as focused on Binyamin, right, that goes a long way, I think, to possibly explain his rationale. Right? It's a commando mission. It's an Entebbe raid. It's whatever I need to do to get Binyamin in front of me safe and sound, and, if necessary, take him in and leave everyone behind and set up the Confederate States of Rachel in Egypt. Right, I'm gonna do because, I don't trust the situation. So that's another possibility. But be that as it may, is this enough for reconciliation? Probably not. What also is missing? What's missing?
What strikes me is the fact that he takes Shimon and the brothers don't argue. Like they don't really protest.
Right.
So it's already he's still kind of feeling like maybe they still should think a brother is expendable, whether it's Binyamin who's
well, that's interesting thought. Do they think that Shimon's expendable? Well, there's nothing much they can do, really. I mean, Yosef says no one's going back. No, right? No one says, I mean, he has the full might of Egypt behind him. I don't know if there's anything they can do.
What happens when it happens to Binyamin, the fact
that Yehuda will,
they're going to not that's willing correct. To stay, let him stay in Mitzvah, and they're going to intervene, which is, of course, a turning point for Yosef.
Right, that's true. That's true, yes.
They seem to feel bad for themselves. They don't seem to feel bad for Yosef.
They seem to feel bad for themselves. It means that this happened to them, this is happening to them. It's a sign. Okay. Actually, I'm going to take you on a short little digression. I wasn't planning on getting into this, but I just can't resist. So I'm just going to give you a little 60-second digression here on this. It's really very fascinating, the wordplay in the story, isn't it? What happens? You ever wonder why Shimon, of all people, why does Yosef choose Shimon? So Rashi says, he's trying to make Shimon and Levi separate. That's certainly a possibility. But if so, why not take Levi? Why is he specifically taking Shimon of all people? So if you think about it, look at this conversation. If you have it, maybe open up to it. I think it's in, where is it? Mikate. The conversation where the brothers are talking to themselves. No, it's not. It's at the end of Vayeshev, right? Where is it? I'm sorry. It's in Mikate. Yeah. Here, let's look at it for 1 second. Follow along with me. Vayomer Isha Lafi, do you have it? Pasuk Chaf Aleph.
Where are you?
Mem Beit, Pasuk Chaf Aleph, chapter 42, verse 21. Vayomru Yish Alachiv, and one man said to another, now notice that no brothers are being named yet. There's simply one brother saying to the other. So the brothers are talking among themselves, and they say these words, we are guilty, Alachinu, about our brother, Asher Ra'inu Tzarat Nafsho, we saw his pain, when he pleaded to us, and we didn't hear, we didn't listen to his cries, Al Kain Barzim Atarazot, that's why this terrible thing is happening to us. Now, I want you to pay attention to the sense perceptions here. Which senses are operative in this sentence? Good. Shaman, lo shamanu, the sense of hearing. There's one more sense. Ra'inu, the sense of sight. There's a sense of sight and the sense of hearing. And asher ra'inu tzarat nafsho, the sense of sight was engaged, right? We saw the pain of Yosef. However, lo shamanu, but we didn't hear, right? As, what's the language here? Asher ra'inu tzarat nafsho, lo shamanu. We didn't listen to his cry. So we saw, but we didn't listen. Now, let's keep on reading. Vayar Reuven, and then Reuven says, Halo amati eleichem lemor al techato vayelad v'lo shamatem. What sense? Notice how seeing has dropped out of the picture, and all we have now is v'lo shamatem again, and we didn't hear. So first, we saw what was happening with the other things, and we didn't listen, and now Reuven is talking and says, I told you, but you wouldn't listen. V'lo shamatem. Now his blood is being taken. The Hain lo yadu, but they didn't realize ki shomea Yosef. Didn't realize that someone was listening. What they were talking about was, we didn't listen to him, and now, believe it or not, he's listening to them, right, without them knowing. Hain lo yadu, they didn't realize ki shomea Yosef kemeris lanotam. Vayisam aleim vayet, he then goes and he cries. Vayashem aleim, Yosef goes back to him. And vayitach mitam et Shimon, it takes Shimon, vayesoreto le'enehem. And he imprisons them le'enehem before their eyes, their sight again. So we open with sight, we end with sight. That opens with them seeing his pain, but not hearing. Reuben says, but you never heard. Yosef then hears, right? And then Yosef imprisons Shimon before their eyes. Now here's the key to this. What does it all mean? Here's what I think it means. Who are the two brothers who we're dealing with here? Shimon is in prison. Reuven is the only brother that steps up and talks. Reuven and Shimon. How did these boys get their names? How did Reuven get named? What did Leah say? Ra'a Hashem ba'anyi. God has seen my suffering. And Shimon? Shama Hashem kisnua anochi. These boys are named for the sense perception of sight and hearing. Reuven represents sight. Shimon represents hearing. But what kind of sight and what kind of hearing? Well, what kind of sight does Reuven represent? Imagine yourself named Reuven. Look at your name. What would you view your life's mission is if you were Reuven? What are you named for? Leah named you after this. Ra'a Hashem ba'anyi. God has seen my pain. Now, if you're Reuven, what do you think your life's mission is? To vindicate your mother's pain, right? It's all about vindicate. So, when Yosef gets this special coat, right, and Yaakov treats him like he's the main guy in the family, and you're Reuven, the first child of Leah, what would you be thinking? This doesn't work, right? I mean, it's not just a slight to me. Who is it really a slight to? My mother! The only thing worse than insulting a kid on the playground is what? Insulting their mother. Right? I mean, this is really bad. What, Leah's kids don't matter? It's only, what, it's like Yosef's the before, first child of Rachel, he's the special one. No, the 11 children get born and nothing until he comes home. This is really, Ra'a Hashem v'ani, what's my job? God himself sees my mother's pain. I am named after this, I see my pain. What's the greatness of Reuven? The greatness of Reuven is that among all the brothers, right, who's the one who says no at the pit? It's really Reuven. Unsuccessfully, he can't get anyone to follow him, but basically Reuven's the only one who categorically thinks this is a really bad idea. He does not want to throw him in the pit. He doesn't think he can convince anybody to go along with him, so he resorts to subterfuge, right? Let's just, throw him in the pit, but he's planning on going back and getting out of the pit. Look at this guy. He's the one more than anyone whose legacy is usurped. He's the Bechor who's out of the picture. He's the one named for seeing his mother's pain. And he's the one who, as he says here, I told you, right, v'lo shamatem, right? Ra'a Hashem, right, the one whose name for Ra'a Hashem to see the pain of my mother, what does he say? Asher ra'inu tzara nafsho. There was seeing. We saw his pain. The seeing guy saw his pain. V'lo shamatem. V'lo shamanu. But we didn't listen. It was the hearing guy. Who's the hearing guy? Shimon. Right? And Yosef hears that. And what did Yosef do? Imprisons Shimon. Right? Because for the first time, he sees the truth. Reuven was not guilty here, right? The only brother, the next brother up, the next oldest brother, was really Shimon. It was Shimon. So really, if you think about it, in a certain way, the challenge of every brother in this story, you might argue, is to actualize their name. Right? Which is, the challenge that every brother faces of the story is the challenge of their own name. Reuven's challenge is, if you're named after God seeing your mother's pain, how are you going to respond when there's the pain of a rival mother? By the way, in Hebrew, how do you speak of a rival mother, a rival wife? It's Sarah. See the play on words here? Asher ra'inu, we saw, sarat nafsho. Anyone, you see that? The play on words. We saw the pain, but the pain of who? The pain of another child, of another one, of a rival mother's child. That's really the question. There's two lessons you can learn from God seeing the pain of your mother. Lesson number one you can learn is a very parochial lesson, a very narrow lesson, which is God's on my side. And my job is to vindicate and get revenge for my mother's pain. And I'll take it out on anyone I view as being associated with causing that pain, and that could be Yosef. But there's another way of viewing your mission, which is God cares about pain. God cares about my mother's pain. And my job is to eradicate that kind of pain wherever I see it, even if I see it on the other side of the family. Right? And that really is, Reuven's greatness. And when Reuven does that, Reuven's greatness is that he's willing to see the pain of a tzara, of the rival wife's child, which is really great. Shimon doesn't succeed in that. Right? It's a more parochial view. Shimon, ki shama Hashem, ki snua melchi, he's not willing to listen to Yosef's pain. So, in any case, just some, you know, interesting wordplay in that story, yes.
Is it possible that Vayishma, that
he cries, yeah.
Isn't that a missed opportunity, but it also presents the possibility that there's an opportunity and possibility? It's a missed opportunity,
yeah.
But it also
right.
presents a...
I think so, that's true. His crying, I think, implies that it could have been an opportunity. And of course, even if it wasn't enough at that moment, by the way, it's still certainly an opportunity. In other words, if Yosef wants to, he can certainly look at Reuven, and he can go and say, that's a good start, and he can reveal himself to his brothers now and says, guys, we've got to talk. Right? I mean, that could have happened, but it didn't. Okay. Next opportunity. I got a lot more to say, and I don't want to keep you here all night, so I'm going to kind of zoom along right now. Okay, next opportunity. Next opportunity is what? He reveals himself. Okay, so then... So in the back, one of the young ladies in the back of the room says, what are we missing? We're missing action, right? Like, put your money where your mouth is. Well, we do get action, don't we? When do we really get action? When do we see that the brothers have sort of done tshuva, if you will? We see it, really, with Yosef's impassioned speech. If you listen to Yosef's impassioned speech, Yehuda's impassioned speech to Yosef, when Yehuda doesn't know who Yosef is, he really lays it on the line. If you think about it, this is the man who is willing to sell the child of a rival, into slavery because of the pain over the division of the family. But what does he say? He says, look, I promised myself as an orev for Binyamin, for this child of Rachel. And listen to these words. He says, that father said, that you know that I only have two children from my wife. How difficult are those words to say for Yehuda? I only have two children from my wife? What about my mother? What about Leah? I mean, she doesn't count. This is the whole reason for the problem in the first place. And now, if I don't bring him back, nafsho k'shurah b'nafsho, his soul is bound up with the soul of Binyamin. He's going to go down to his grave mourning him. I know that he loves him more. I know he loves him more because he loves his mother more than he loves my mother. and he loves him, but anyway, I can't bear to do this to my father, so you have to take me instead. I mean, that's really something. That's really something. That's real heroism on the part of Yehuda. If you talk about kids actualizing their name, by the way, what does Yehuda mean? Yehuda gets his name from what word? Hoda'ah. Right, gratitude, admission. This is a very powerful admission. Right? Is Yehuda actualizing his name properly? Is this enough for reconciliation? Well, it's enough certainly for Yosef to reveal himself. Right? The question is it over at this point? He's put his money where his mouth is. You can make the argument, by the way, you can make the argument, I don't really believe this argument, but you can make this argument, that this is pretty close to what the Rambam describes as tshuva gemura. Right? What is tshuva gemura according to the Rambam? What is complete, utter tshuva? The Rambam says there are different levels of tshuva. There's standard tshuva, then there's platinum level tshuva. Right? Platinum level tshuva, tshuva gemura is when you find yourself in the same position and you don't do it. Well, this is Yehuda. Yehuda finds himself in the same position and he doesn't do it. So maybe this is it. This is reconciliation. So the question is, what is missing? Is anything missing at this point? Is anything missing? There's still something missing. What's missing?
They don't apologize.
Right. There's no conversation. There's no apology. The problem is they don't realize that Yosef is Yosef. They don't know who they're talking to. Yehuda doesn't know who he's talking to in this speech. So even though, interestingly enough, they're talking to Yosef, had they known who they were talking to, it might be enough. But they don't know who they're talking to. What's missing is a conversation when they know who they're talking to. A real conversation. In other words, it's not enough just for people to change. What has to happen is a conversation. If we go, do they ever have that conversation? And the answer is yes, they do have that conversation. The key story to look at, if you want to know whether they reconciled, is actually the very last story in Bereishis. It's the story at the end of Vayechi, where the brothers, after all these years, finally bring up the pit, and they ask themselves, and they come and they ask forgiveness from Yosef. That's really the moment. That's the conversation. That's the moment where they really come to apologize. So the question is, does it happen then or not? Right? So in a moment, we're going to look at this conversation. But before we do, I just want to set the scene by asking ourselves this question. We're going to do this sort of scientifically, which is in order to judge whether we think the conversation worked or not, let's try to set up a model in our own mind for what has to happen. Well, let's try to imagine what has to happen in that conversation. In other words, if you would imagine Yosef behind that door over there, and the brothers behind this door over there, and in a second they're going to meet, and they're going to have this conversation, right? What would you want to get said in this conversation? You're the counselor, you're the therapist, you've got to, you know, counsel each side. This is what you do. This is how this conversation has to go. What would have to happen in this conversation to work? Right? What would have to happen? Right? Anybody? So, where do we get the... Anyone want to take a stab at that? What has to happen in that room to work? So, yeah?
I think the brothers have to confess that they did something wrong to him and, in essence, beg his forgiveness and imply that they wish that he would be kind to them and loving to them.
Something like that. And Yosef has to be able to accept that. Really, the model for this comes from the Rambam and Hilchos Teshuvah. Okay, Maimonides, the Rambam lays out the model. When you think about Hilchos Teshuvah, really what Hilchos Teshuvah are, it's really the halachas of reconciliation, if you really think about it. There is a halachic process by which this happens. Right? What is that process? What's the process that's laid out in Rambam Hilchos Teshuvah? So I want to take us on a short diversion for just a few minutes to take a look at the Rambam Hilchos Teshuvah, where he sort of outlines and then what has to happen, and we can sort of apply it back to the Yosef case. Here's what the Rambam says in the Laws of Teshuvah. He says a couple interesting things. A, he says there are a number of components to Teshuvah. Actually, even before we get to A, let me start with this. You know that there's 613 commandments in the Torah. One of the great famous questions about the Rambam, or about, you know, life in general, is Teshuvah itself one of these commandments? In other words, is one of Taryag, one of the 613 commandments, is there a mitzvah in the Torah called doing tshuva when you've done something wrong? Is there such a mitzvah? So you think 613 commandments is a lot of commandments, so there's got to be one for tshuva, right? You know, pretty important command. So what does the Rambam say about this? Is there in fact a mitzvah for tshuva? So I read to you the Rambam. You tell me if you think the Rambam believes that there's a mitzvah called tshuva or not. Here's what the Rambam says. Any command in the Torah, they not say, they lo tasei, whether it's positive or negative, if a person transgressed any one of these commandments in the Torah, whether he did it on purpose or he did it by accident, Kishayas the tshuva, when he does tshuva, when he repents, the yashu mecheta, when he returns from the sin, chayavli hitvadotli tmeyakel baruchu, he needs to confess his sin. He's required to confess his sin before God. Vidu izeh mitzvot aseh. This confession is, in fact, a positive commandment. And then he explains how you do confession. Okay, has the Rambam said that there's a mitzvah to do tshuva or not? What? Ah, so it sounds like it's a positive commandment, right? But listen carefully what the Rambam says. What? Right. The Rambam says is that if you do tshuva, then there is a positive commandment to confess. Right? Very interesting. The Rambam does not say that if you do something wrong, there's a positive commandment to do tshuva. The Rambam says when you do something wrong, and if you choose to do tshuva, when you choose to do tshuva, there is a mitzvah to include in that tshuva a process known as vidui, which is called confession. Now, what's strange about this is that if you look at the Rambam later, the Rambam actually breaks tshuva down to its different components. And you will find that tshuva is one of four components, vidui, confession, is one of four components of tshuva. So what's really odd is that the Rambam seems to be singling out one of these four components and saying the mitzvah lies here, right? Doing tshuva is more or less optional. Even doing vidui is more or less optional. If you're deciding to do tshuva, then you have to include vidui in the tshuva. It's a very strange kind of mitzvah. Where does this come from? Tshuva is optional. How could tshuva be optional? Yom Kippur is optional. And what does this mean? That somehow Rambam says, yeah, you know, you want to do tshuva, you decide whether you want to do tshuva. But if you do tshuva, you have to decide, you have to include vidui. That's a mitzvah. How do we understand that? And why is Rambam singling out one component of tshuva specifically out of all the others? Let's just talk about what the other ones are, by the way. What does the Rambam pass up in terms of the other three components of tshuva, which are not, according to the Rambam, a mitzvah, but are required, according to the Rambam, for tshuva, even basic level tshuva? What are these components?
Harata.
Andiva sachet. And? Kabbalah or Azir. So the other three are regret. I have to regret that I've done the thing that's wrong. That's one element. Aziva sachet, which means I have to stop doing the thing that's wrong. And Kabbalah al-Asid, I have to accept in the future not to do that thing. Okay? So now we're going to play one of my favorite games, which I learned as a kid from Sesame Street. I don't know if you guys are big Sesame Street fans, but in Sesame Street, there's this great game, and they have four boxes up on the screen, and they play which one of these things is not like the other. You know the music, which one of these things is not like the other. And you get like 30 seconds, you see the thing, you've got to like sit there and figure out which one of these things is not like the other. So imagine we were doing this with the four elements of tshuva. They got up on the screen, charata, right, remorse, aziva sachet, leaving behind the sin, kavala asid, deciding not to do it again, and vidui, and we don't have a Rambam, right, and confession, but we just got the music playing, right, for 30 seconds. You've got to pick which one of these is fundamentally unlike the others, which would it be and why? It would be vidui. Vidui is fundamentally unlike the others. How is vidui different than all of these other ones? So, how is it different?
It's not the
way. It's an action.
Okay, it's an action as opposed to? Not, okay, maybe. But I will argue to you that aziva sachet is pretty close to an action. Aziva sachet, it's the lack of an action, maybe, but it's stopping to do the thing that's wrong. For my money, I'll call that an action.
But vidui is interpersonal. You have to interact with somebody else.
Okay, good. The way that vidui is really different is that vidui is interpersonal and requires interacting with someone else. All of the other three components do not require interaction with anyone but you. Think about it. Remorse is something I do all by myself, right? Stopping to do something wrong, I can do unilaterally. I just have to decide to stop it. Accepting not to do it in the future, I can do unilaterally, right? I just have to decide that I'm not going to do anything in the future. Everything here is unilateral. The only thing that's not unilateral, that takes two to tango, is vidui. Vidui is not just confessing to myself. Sometimes we make that mistake. We think, oh yeah, you just mumbled this confession. No. The Rambam was very clear that it is confessing to someone. Which someone? Not necessarily God. So it's confessing to whomever you wronged. Whoever was the victim of the wrong, that you confess to. Now, every wrong, to some extent, wronged God, so you have to confess to God. But if it's interpersonal, between personal, you have to confess to the person as well. Confession to the one that you wronged. So Vidui is different because it's interpersonal. So let's leave Vidui out for a moment and just talk about the other elements of Truma. I want to really understand why, what the nature of the relationship between Vidui and the other elements are and how they work together. So let's talk about this for a second. Let's forget about Vidui for a second and just look at the other elements of Truma. How do we understand that? Why does Truma have to have these three elements? Where do we come up with these three elements from? Brahmanists like decided to like go in a hat and say, oh, you know what Truma is? It's got these three elements. There's remorse, there's, you know, and you got to memorize it in school, every yom and the rhyme, and you have to test on this. So it's like, why do we have these three elements of Truma? What's the logic in these three elements of Truma? So, like, imagine this is the SATs. So you remember on the SATs they have this question, what's the best title for this paragraph? You know that question? They give you this paragraph, so you have to pick the best title for the paragraph. So imagine the paragraph is these three elements of Truma. Right? Everything except for Vidui, and you have to come up with the best title. What would you say this thing is? And you can't use the word Truma. So, the paragraph includes remorse, it includes Aziva Sahait, not doing the thing that's wrong, it includes Kabbalah al-Asid, accepting the future not to do it. What title is paragraph? Can't use the word Truma. What is it?
Future.
Okay, good. So, what things you're pointing out, interestingly enough, is that these three things relate two different time periods. Isn't that interesting? Right? Remorse relates to what time period? Past. Kabbalah Asid, acceptance not to do it again, relates to what kind of time period? The future. Aziva Sakait, not doing the thing that's wrong, relates to what time period? The present. It's very interesting that we have past, present, and future related, which makes you wonder, what? Maybe they're all about the same thing. It's just one expresses itself in the past, one expresses itself in the present, and one expresses itself in the future. In other words, maybe they're all the same. Maybe what Aziva Sachet is in the present, Kabbalah Asid is in the future, and remorse is in the past. So what is that thing? How would you define the nature of that thing? Okay, I would say both of you are right, but I would take that as the best definition. Renouncing the act, or maybe I would put it slightly differently, distancing myself from the act, getting away from the act, getting away from the sin. That's what it was. No, it's all. I would even say Aziva Zachet is the title, right? Leaving the sin behind. But how do you leave the sin behind? There are different elements of leaving a sin behind. I actually got a new insight into this just today as I was driving in a cab actually on the way here. I was looking through an interesting book which I just happened to get my hands on. It's a book written by, I think it's Daniel Gilbert, who's a professor of psychology at Harvard University, and it's a very fascinating book. It's called Stumbling on Happiness, actually. And have you read it? And just in the introduction of this book, he makes a very interesting claim. He says that, you know, all psychologists, at some point in their career, need to utter the sentence. And the sentence begins with the words, right, a human being is the only animal that. And then every psychologist gets to fill in what the that is, you know, decide how you define what our essential humanity is. And he says that most psychologists like to wait until the very end of their careers before they utter the sentence because they get, you know, shown up after a while. You know, when a chimpanzee decides to talk, you know, then his mailing address and number gets blasted all over the air news, you know, you thought it was all about talking. So he says, I'm going to take the plunge, but I'm going to try to define humanity my way. Here's how he wants to define humanity. He says humanity is, a human being is the only animal that anticipates the future. Very interesting argument. He argues that in human evolution, the evolution of the frontal lobe of the brain, is part of the brain that allows us, that's unique to human beings, and it allows us to anticipate and plan and think about the future. If you look at experiments with people who have damage or loss of their ability to use the frontal lobe, they also have a complete loss of ability to plan or even think about the future. If you talk to people who have lost their frontal lobe about what tomorrow is like, what they plan on doing tomorrow, they simply can't understand the question. They will describe to you it's like swimming in a sea without, and they just can't get their arms around what does that really mean, to think about the future in that kind of way. So if you think about, and he makes the argument that if you think about what life would be like without this, right, the way the rest of the animal world lives, aside from humanity, think about what a prison it would be if you could not think about the future. right? If you cannot plan about right for the future, if you cannot think about tomorrow, if you cannot think about, if all you were doing is you were locked in the eternal present, what would that be like? What a prison. Now you might say, what do you mean what a prison? The future is the future, I'll get to it when I get to it. But it's not. The future informs now. Your ability to think and anticipate the future is part of what makes your experience now meaningful. You can anticipate things in the future and delight in them now. You can anticipate things in the future and be afraid of them now. It changes your now. So, for example, they found that people with frontal lobe injuries, not only can they not anticipate the future, but their anxiety goes down. So people, psychiatrists used to give frontal lobe lobotomies, right, to people who had very high depression and anxiety, because they found that if you took away people's frontal lobes, they had no more anxiety. Well, that makes a lot of sense. Why? Because if I can't think about the future, of course, I have nothing to be anxious about anymore, right? There's nothing to worry about, right? But you're in this perpetual sea of the present without any way out, and it's very demoralizing. Your humanity is gone. Now, if you think about that, that's the flip side of Alzheimer's. Right? Alzheimer's is the most feared disease next to cancer. Right? What's so scary about Alzheimer's? It's the same sense, the loss of our humanity. Because part of what makes us human is not just our ability to anticipate the future, it's also our ability to recall the past. Why? Because the past isn't just the past. The past continues to inform our present. The past makes the present rich. And if you lose the past, HBO is doing this documentary now on Alzheimer's. If you look at this documentary, what's her name? Maria Shriver, the first lady in California, narrated the second piece of this. It was really moving. It was talking about children dealing with adults or their grandparents who have Alzheimer's. And the one phrase you hear over and over again from the children, the great fear is, right, what happens when my grandfather won't be able to remember me anymore? I mean, this is the worst thing. Why? Because it's not just the past. It's the present. The present is impacted. You change. If you can't remember, it feels almost like your humanity is slipping away. So interestingly enough, our humanity is tied up in our ability to now experience the past and to now experience the future. And if we can do all of that, then we feel like we're fully human. If we can't, we feel like at some level our humanity slips away from us. What is tshuva? Tshuva is using those unique faculties of the human being to rehabilitate sin. How do we do that? Since we're human, and since as humans, we experience the future now, and we experience the past now, and the past and the future we bring to bear upon our experience and make the present out of that, the only way that you can get rid of sin, the only way you can distance yourself from sin, is not enough to say, I'm not doing it anymore. You have to say, I'm not doing this anymore now, and I'm not doing it anymore with reference to the future. I'm not doing it anymore with reference to the past. Why? Not because of the future, it's because of the now. Let me explain what it means. This is it's really, I don't want to get into this in too much detail because it's a more complicated excursion into the Rambam than I want to do tonight. But I just will say this. You ever get depressed by the Rambam's definition of tshuva? I'll tell you why you should be depressed. Here's why you should be depressed. Because the Rambam says that you know how you have to be, how you know what kind of tshuva you have to do, right, in Kabbalah laws in the future. You have to do a tshuva that God himself looks at you, right, and says you're never going to go back to this. Now that's depressing. Why? Because frankly, boys and girls, when we all get to Yom Kippur, right, it's like, and you do your tshuva for, you know, Lashon Hara and your long list of sins that you did tshuva on last year, right, and the year before, and then you look at this Rambam and says, the Rambam says that God himself is going to have to say, not going to do this again. You think, well, that, you know, I'm a goner. That's never going to happen. I mean, obviously, I mean, right? What does it mean, though? It doesn't mean that you're never going to get back to it again, right? There's no guarantees about the future. You don't know about the future. What it means is that the quality of your leaving it behind now has to be a full leaving it behind, such that if you would ever get back to the future, it's a new act of getting to it. It's not that simply there's some residue in what's going on here. It's this idea from Martin Gilbert again. It's this idea that the future influences the present. You are who you are in the present because of the future. You have to renounce it in the future in order for your present renunciation to be meaningful. Let me take this out of the abstract and make it very real for a second. Let's make this very concrete. Let's say, here I'm a guy, right? I'm a day before, I'm a rabbi, right? But I have to confess to you, I have this peculiar sin that I'm really trying to work on, right? Every Yom Kippur, I have this hankering for cheeseburgers, right? I go into McDonald's,
I eat these cheeseburgers, run around and eat you all the time. It's just I can't help myself. But last Yom Kippur, right, I really felt a need to change this awful behavior, right? So what am I going to do to change this awful behavior? So what's the guy to do if he eats cheeseburgers around the Eilat time every Yom Kippur? So one thing you have to do is you have to do Aziva Sachet, right? Which means that comes the Eilat time around Yom Kippur, you've got to be in shul and not in McDonald's, right? Which is that you have to leave behind the sin. You are not going to be there in McDonald's. But that's not enough. Why is that not enough? Right? I'm not doing it anymore. I've done tshuva. Why is that not enough? The answer is, because if somebody comes to me and says, hey, Foreman, I see you're in shul this Yom Kippur. You know, what are you doing? You're usually in McDonald's. What are you doing here? So I say, no, I've turned over a new leaf, you know. I'm not eating cheeseburgers anymore. I'm trying to down the meal this year. And I'm changing. So he says, oh, yeah, but last year you're in McDonald's. What do you think of last year? Now, what if my answer is, oh, man, that was the greatest experience ever. You know, you have no idea. I can still think, I can smell the cheeseburgers now. You know, as a matter of fact, so hard to sit here standing in the meal. I'm only getting by the fumes of those cheeseburgers that I remember from last year. You would say, like, something's missing, right? You know, he hasn't really let go yet, right? In order to let go now, I have to renounce my memory of the past and say, if I had to do it again in the past, now I would do it without the cheeseburgers. Now, if I did all that, I renounce the past, and then he says to me, so Foreman, what about next year? And I say, huh, next year's another year, right? You know, we'll worry about that when we get there, you know? We'll see. Let's not make any hasty decisions. You would still say, he hasn't really let go, right? You have to be able to let go now for the future and for the past in order for your letting go now to be meaningful. Okay, so part of tshuva is letting go. The essence of tshuva is letting go. But what's interesting is if you do all this, if you really let go completely, you let go now, you let go for the past, you let go for the future, you really let go, the Rambam says, guess what? You haven't done anything yet. This is nothing. Because until you do vidui, you've done nothing. The mitzvah is vidui. So you say, what do you mean I've done nothing? I've done everything. I've let go. Look at everything I've done. This is such great spiritual work that I've done. Why do I have to do vidui? What is the Rambam telling you by saying you've done nothing until you've done vidui? The Rambam is saying that everything I've done now, until now, is intrapersonal. It's all between me and myself. I haven't done anything with me and the one whom I sin to. What does this mean that the mitzvah of tshuva really is? What is tshuva and what isn't it? What the Rambam is telling you is that tshuva is not the same thing as self-improvement. Tshuva is not about making yourself a better person. The three elements of tshuva, right, make you a better person, but that's not the mitzvah. There is no mitzvah to make yourself a better person. You want to elevate your spiritual status. You want to become high and wonderful and spiritual and let go of sins that drag you down. Go ahead. You choose to do that, right? That tshuva is not about how to win friends and influence people. It's not, you know, the seven habits of highly successful people. It's not self-help. It's not making you better. You know what tshuva is? What the mitzvah is to rehabilitate the relationships with others that you've damaged by virtue of your sin. You have obligations towards others. Right? That sin has had an impact on your relationships. It's had an impact on your relationship with God. It's had an impact on your relationship with others. Fix it. You want to change? If you want to change, there's a mitzvah that when you change, make sure you change right. Changing right means don't just make yourself better. It means rehabilitate the damaged relationship. The only way you do that is bringing the other being into the mix, whether it's God or another person, and confessing to them and saying, here is what I've done. This is the sin. This is what I've done. What does that do when you bring that interpersonal element in, when you bring vidui in? So the Rambam tells you, and he tells you in a very fascinating analogy. He says, you know what vidui is like? It's like a mikvah, he says. Doing vidui is like going into a mikvah. He says, if you try apologizing without letting go of the sin, that's like going into a mikvah and still holding on to an insect that makes you impure. Okay? It's like Tovah B'Sheretz B'Yado. If you try going into the mikvah, doing this apology, right, it's like going into a mikvah, but if you haven't let go, if you haven't done tshuva, then it's like you're still holding on to the sin. What is tshuva? Tshuva is letting go of the sin, like we said before. That's what tshuva is. It's letting go of the sin in past, present, and future. If you do that, then you're letting go of the sheriff, you're letting go of the impure insects which will make you impure, and that alone will not make you pure, but now if you go into the mikvah, you do the apology, which is like going to the mikvah, that will make you pure. Rav is saying a fascinating thing. The magic in tshuva is the mikvah. The magic of tshuva is vidui. Everything until then is just preparatory. It's so that going to the mikvah works. But there's something magical about vidui. It's transformative, the way a mikvah is transformative. What is so transformative about vidui? The word vidui, interestingly, from Yehuda's name, right, yada, if you think about it grammatically, the word yada, hoda'a, means something besides confession. Confession is one of its meaning, one of its meanings. So what else does hoda'a mean besides confession? It also means to say thank you. Isn't that strange? That there should be one Hebrew word for two things in English. Thank you and I'm sorry. There should be one Hebrew word. Why would the Hebrew language have one word for two different concepts? Thank you and I'm sorry. Must be. They are two different concepts. Must be from the perspective of the Hebrew language, they're one concept. How is thank you and I'm sorry really one concept? Right? Let's think about that for a moment. How is thank you and I'm sorry really one concept? So let's talk about that. How do you say thank you without saying thank you? Try saying thank you without the word. What makes thank you work? How do you say thank you? How do you say I'm sorry? How do you say thank you without using the words thanks? Anyone? I appreciate it. To say I appreciate it is the same thing as saying thank you. What does those words mean? I appreciate it. Translate appreciate. What does the word appreciate mean?
Hold the value.
Hold the value of. Understand the value of. I appreciate means to understand the value of what you've done. What does it mean to say thank you? If you think about it, what is the mechanics? What are you really doing when you say thank you? If you think about it, the easy way to think about it is the following. Relationships between human beings like being in balance. But there's ways to get your relationships out of balance. How do you get your relationships out of balance? Well, there's good ways and there's bad ways. Let's say I move into the neighborhood and you do me these favors, you come over with these fruit baskets and you help my kids with your homework and you invite me over, right? All of a sudden you've done me this favor and what's happened to our relationship? Right? Our relationship is out of balance. What do I want to do if you're doing me all these favors? I want to reciprocate, right? Because if I reciprocate, I can get the relationship back in balance, right? Okay, now there's bad ways that relationships can get out of balance, which is, let's say there's something really nasty to you, right? If I do something really mean and nasty to you, so again, our relationships are out of balance. And what does the other guy want to do with me if I've done something really nasty to them? They want to take revenge. Revenge is sweet because it brings balance back into the relationship. But what if you say, I'm not the kind of guy who wants to take revenge? Or, what if the good kind of thing happens and someone's done you a favor and you have no way to reciprocate the favor? What do you do when you can't reciprocate a favor? You're stuck with this imbalanced relationship. It's very uncomfortable. By the way, this is such a fundamental aspect of human nature that people can use it to your disadvantage too. So for example, if you go into a used car showroom, you're looking for a car, salesman sits you down, invites you, says, oh, you know, you look thirsty, we'd like a can of Coke. Don't take the can of Coke. Why? Because if you take the can of Coke, what just happened? You, okay. There's no way to reciprocate except for buying his car. That was a 25-cent can of Coke. The car is $25,000, and you're going to buy the car psychologically because you just got a Coke. That's the way it works, right? Kinyan Pesach, by the way, is based upon this methodology also, but that's another schmooze. So the idea is, it's very powerful, these kind of relationships things. What do you do if you can't reciprocate, if you won't reciprocate, if you don't want to take revenge, if you can't repay a favor? You know what you do then? Hodah. The act of hodah. The act of hodah obviates the need to do this. What is hodah? Hodah is recognition. Recognition of the imbalance. What I'm about to tell you makes no sense. I'm going to tell you something that makes no sense, is completely illogical, but is true anyway. Okay? Here's the idea. When your relationships get out of balance with someone, if you can look that imbalance in the, look that person in the eye and recognize the existence of the imbalance and really understand it
and convey to that person that you understand it, you know what happens? The imbalance goes away. Makes no sense. What, you're looking the imbalance in the eye. If anything, you're fortifying the imbalance. You're saying it's really there. If you do that and the other person accepts that you did it, the imbalance goes away. It's a very strange thing. It's so counterintuitive that if you ask kids how you apologize, you know what kids will sometimes tell you? They'll say, you know how you say I'm sorry? You say, I didn't mean to do it. Why is that not the way you say you're sorry? What if they did mean to do it? Then you're not recognizing the truth. You're not recognizing what really happened. Recognize means, no, I recognize, I understand what I did. I understand how I could have done it differently. I really get it. If I really get it, or if I understand, I appreciate the favor you've done to me, the imbalance goes away. Tversky, Rabbi Tversky, the psychologist, the psychiatrist, always came from 5 pounds once. This is what he said. He says, there's only 3 words you need to know to have a successful marriage. Right? The 3 words of a successful marriage is, not I love you, interestingly enough. Right? He says, thank you, I'm sorry, and I admire you. Those are the only 3 words you need. Fascinatingly, there's the 3 aspects of Hoda'ah. In Hebrew, it's 1 word for all 3. Why? Because those are the 3 ways we balance relationships. What do you think? I have a great marriage, so my relationships will never get out of balance, or whenever she does anything bad, I'll take revenge against her. Right? That was not the secret. You have to have a way, right? You've got to have a way of restoring balance to a relationship without revenge, or without constantly repaying every favor. The way is real hoda'ah. When you look at another person in the eye and say, I get it. I understand what I did and how I could have done it differently. I'm sorry. I really regret it. Do you understand that I understand? If the other person can understand that, that is an apology. That is hoda'ah. That is bidui. That's the mikvah. The mikvah is the magic. That is the transformative moment in the relationship. So on Yom Kippur, if you're wondering, if you think it's a long davening, right, and you want to know what to stay in for and what's it really all about, it's really about those 3 words of Alanachnu Chatanu Lefanecha, which is the soul of Vigui. That's really what it's about. It's about that transformative moment. That's what it's about. In the story of Yosef, that's what needs to happen. Right? The brothers have left it behind. Yosef, Yehuda's left it behind. Not only they left it behind, he's in the same position before, he doesn't do it. It's true but more. The only element that's missing is the Vigui element. Is the Vigui there? So let's read it. The end of Vayechi. Yaakov is dead. The brothers have just buried Yaakov. Yosef and the brothers have gone to Canaan and they come back home. Pasuk Yud Dalet Perek Nun. Vayoshev Yosef Yitzrayim, Yosef comes back to Egypt, Huva Echav, he and his brothers and everyone who had went with them to bury his father. Vayiru Acha Yosef Kimet Aviyah. And the brothers saw that their father had died. Now there's something strange about that, isn't it? What do you mean the brothers saw their father die? They just buried him. Obviously they knew his brother died. Rashi's bothered by this. Rashi says it doesn't mean they saw their father die. It means they understood the implications of their father's death. Which is, the way Rashi puts it, they saw that Yosef was treating him a little differently. Yosef's smile in the hallway wasn't quite the same as it was before. They saw the difference that father was dead. And they were worried. And this is what they said. By Yomru, they said, Lu Yisdemenu Yosef. Maybe Yosef will hate us. Vashev Yashiv Lanu Et Kol HaRa Asher Gamalanu Oto. And he'll take revenge against us for all the bad that we did to him. Lu Yisdemenu Yosef. Maybe Yosef will hate us. The word Yisdemenu appears only one other time in Bereshit. Right? Satam. Anyone knows, it's a very unusual word for hatred. Right? It's not Sina, it's Satam. Right? When else do we have Satam? It's not the bracha, but it's with Esav. It's when Vayistam Esav et Yaakov, ala bracha sheberach ha'anu. Esav hated his brother for a grudge, and you know what he said? Yikruvu yimei evalavi. My father is going to die soon. Vaharga et Yaakov achi. And I'll kill Yaakov, my brother. In the next generation, what happens? In the next generation, there was another brother that tricked another, you know, that pulled a fast one, right? And what are they worried about? Maybe Yosef's going to act like Esav. Maybe he too is bearing a grudge. Maybe the grudge will come out when? When father's dead. When father's dead, the death of a father, by the way, is the last thing that really holds together a family. After father's dead, Right? Who knows what can happen? Maybe the grudge will come out. Maybe he'll kill us now. Lu Yisimenu Yosef. Hashem Yashiv Lanu Es Paro. Especially chilling, by the way, is the word Lu. What does the word Lu mean? Lu Yisimenu Yosef. Lu means? Anyone know?
Less.
Less. Right. Lu means less. Less our brothers will hate us. Maybe our brothers will hate us. Now Rashi points out, very fascinating thing, that Lu seems to be the wrong word. Because there is a word for Hebrew, in Hebrew for less, but it's not Lu, it's ten. Right? They should have said ten Yisimenu. Right? In Hebrew there are three words for maybe. There's ten, ulai, and Lu. It's fleshing, melting, and par. Right? Lu is hopeful, right? If only it would be. Ten is unhopeful. I hope it isn't. And ulai is par. It could go either way. You would think it should be ten, but it's Lu. So Rashi says, well, Lu means ten here, but I don't know another time in all of Chumash where Lu means ten. This is what Rashi says. So you have to wonder, okay, so why does it say Lu if it really meant ten? At some level, there's a Lu here. Even though it's really ten, what's the Lu? At what level are the brothers hopeful that Yosef might hate them? What? Maybe they want to balance that. If only Yosef would hate us anymore. Or it's almost like, you know, those Alfred Hitchcock movies, right? Why are those the most suspenseful kind of movies? Right? Modern horror movies show you all the gore, and they're not as scary as the old 1950 movies that don't show you anything. Because that's the real scary part, when you don't see anything. When there's this constant anticipation of what's going to happen. The brothers are seeing Yosef smile in the hallway. What are they saying? If only he'd hate us already. Right? When's another shoe going to drop? Lu Yisimenu Yosef. If only it would happen already. So what happens? Into this context, they begin to have a conversation with Yosef. And this is what they say. They said to Yosef, Father commanded before his death the following. Thus you should say to Yosef, please say the following to Yosef. Please bear the iniquity of your brothers and their sin, because they have done evil to you. And now please bear the sin of your brothers, right, of the servants of your father's God. Yosef cried when they said this to him. What do you say, folks? Is it vidui or not?
No.
Pretty close. The Rambam defines vidui as a subject, a verb, and an object. The subject is the simple sentence, I have sinned before you. Very simple sentence. Grammatically, the subject is I, the verb is have sinned, the object is before you. Now that simple sentence is incredibly hard to say. So if you actually look at apologies, especially in the political realm, you'll find all sorts of ways of not saying the subject, the verb, and the object. Richard Nixon's favorite apology was, mistakes were made in my administration. Analyze that. Where's the subject? I don't know. Mistakes were made. Who made them? Beats me. What about the verb? Well, there were mistakes that were made. There weren't sins. I mean, it's not like anyone did anything wrong. Everyone makes mistakes, right? Who did they affect? Who's the object that they affected? I don't know. They were made. They didn't affect anyone. There's no subject. There's no verb. There's no object. You can have an apology that's not really an apology at all. The sad thing about apologies, the nasty little thing about apologies is that they're incredibly potent, incredibly effective. They're like a mikvah, but there's very little partial credit. Which is that how easy is it if someone's really hurt you and they come to you and they're apologizing and you're listening, and you're listening, and they don't quite get it, right? They don't really get how they could have acted differently, or they're not really saying they've done anything wrong, it's a mistake. If there's anything missing, it's not so easy to let go. There's very little partial credit. It just doesn't work. What do the brothers do here? They say, Dad commanded before he says, Dad says you're supposed to forgive us. Dad says that you're supposed to bear the iniquity of our God, but right, because the Dad says we've hurt you. So there's the object, Yosef who's been hurt. There's the subject, there's the sin. Sorry, there's the verb, there's the sin. The only thing that's missing is the subject, which is the I, the we. Instead of we, what is there? There's Dad. Dad says you're supposed to forgive it. There's something else, too, which is that it's a request for forgiveness, which is not the same as an apology. And this is one of my pet peeves. Erev Yom Kippur, what do we all do? We walk around. What do? We ask for forgiveness. Some people say, would you be mochel me? If you take anything out of this talk, do not do that, this Erev Yom Kippur. There's something morally perverse about it. Why? What happens when you do not apologize to someone, so you come up to them and says, you know, will you be mochel me? You know what you're doing? You are obtusely inverting moral responsibility in the situation, which is that you're the jerk who can't forgive me if you don't forgive. I'm not saying what I did wrong. I'm not even apologizing. I'm just saying you're supposed to let go, so would you please forgive me for anything I might have done. Right? But that's not the same thing as saying, you know, I think I haven't lived up to my responsibilities because, yeah, I fear. Right? Would you please forgive me? That's a different kind of thing. In any case, the brothers are asking for forgiveness. It's not the same thing as apologizing. If they're apologizing, they're hiding behind father. And Rashi says something chilling. Did the father ever say this? Rashi says the brothers are lying. The father never said it, but Rashi says it's a justifiable lie. Because we all know the Gemara. When are you allowed to lie? Shinu b'davar b'mseya shalom. If it's going to preserve the peace, you're allowed to lie. The brother said, we're mashanim b'mseya shalom. Right? In order to bring about peace in the family, let's say the father is commanding you to forgive us. But there's a bitter irony in that, Rashi. The irony is, they're lying to preserve the peace. But what are they doing? They're hiding behind the father. They're not saying the real apology. They're hiding behind the father. If only they hadn't lied. If only they really said it. If only they said I instead of father, what would have happened? There would have really been peace. By lying to keep the peace, maybe they perpetuated the war. And when Yosef cries, there's two ways to interpret the tears. One possibility is he's so filled with forgiveness, he's crying, but there's another possibility. If you were there and brothers came to you after 20 years, how did you live these last 20 years with these brothers? How would you have lived? Imagine somebody wronged you in this kind of way, had this kind of dramatic impact on your life. And what did you do? You didn't cut them out of your will. You didn't cut them out of your life. You still wanted to have a relationship with them, but you never talked about it. How do you do that? Psychologically, you know what you do? You partition your brain, right? And you wall off this area of pain. You say, I'm not going there. I'm not going in there. You have this relationship that just doesn't go there. And then one day, they come to you and say, we've got to talk. What's happening then? They're opening the door on that partition. And you walk into that room that you haven't been for 20 years, and you're hoping, your hopes are up, that somehow you will reconcile. And then what happens if there's this attempt at an apology, but it's not really? You cry. Why do you cry? Because now you're left with this pain that you weren't exposed to until now, and you're back, and you find that you just can't quite let go. But you want to let go. So what does Yosef do? Yep. Yosef cries. When they see Yosef crying, they then fall before him. And they say, let us be your slaves. Why are they saying that? They must have intuited what? That it wasn't enough. That it wasn't over. So they tried something else. So they said, you can take revenge upon us. We made you into a slave. Let us be your slaves. If you're Yosef, though, is this what you want? You're not looking for revenge. Right? You're looking for reconciliation. So they said, we can be your slaves. So it's not a matter of revenge hitting us back. But that's what they say. What's Yosef's response? Vayomer aleihem Yosef, al tirau, don't be afraid. Ki atachat Elokim ani. Because am I in place of God? Very strange words. What does he mean by that? Am I in place of God? You get a clue by his next sentence. Vatem chashavtem alai ra, look guys, you thought to do bad to me back in that pit when you threw him into the pit. Look at Ashtapha. Elohim chashva l'tova. God made it turn out okay. L'man asaf hayom azela hayot amra. To bring us this wonderful day that I could take care of you. I could provide you with all this food. And by providing you with all this food, I'm making you into a great nation. Look how you've been able to multiply. Because I've been able to give you this food. It's all for the best. Don't you see the Ashtapha? You thought you were doing bad to me. It really turned out into good. So, what are you asking me forgiveness for, he says? Hatachat Elohim ani.
Am I in place of God? You want to know God's opinion? You have to ask God. But it seems to me that, look at the Hashkacha. You know, you thought you were doing such a bad thing. God made it work out okay. So probably, God thinks it's okay. So let's just call it a day. Okay, now what was missing there? Does he ever forgive them? No. Essentially, they're asking for forgiveness, and what does he do? He actually changes the subject, right? Basically, he's saying, why are we talking about forgiveness? Right? We know you're talking about forgiveness. Hatachat Elokim ani, am I in place of God? What does that imply? It's not my job. Whose job is forgiveness? God. God is the judge in heaven. Let God be the judge. And anyway, you know, I think God probably thinks it's okay. Because look, you're doing this terrible thing. And this is what God means. You know, God means this wonderful day, the Achayot Amrav, right? And what does he do? Ata Alziro, don't be afraid. I'm Melchi Achalka, Atzkem, I'll take care of you. Atzkem, I'll take care of your children. Vayinachem Otam. And he comforted them. Vayidaber Alibam. He spoke soothing words to their heart. So it sounds like it's all over. It sounds like Yosef let go. He's being nice. He's being sweet. I believe that if you ask Yosef after this conversation, is it over? I have no way of knowing. I'm just speculating. But my bet is Yosef would have said it's over. Look, I did whatever I could. I've comforted them. I've told them the nicest possible things. I've let go. But there are chilling Rashis here. Every last Rashi. I can't do all of them at the time, but every last Rashi here will keep you up at night. If you want to go read these Rashis, you won't be able to sleep. I'll just tell you one of them, which will give you, the beginning of a nightmare, but you can read the rest of them if you want the real nightmare scenario. Rashi speculates. What are the nice things that Yosef said? When he comforts them and speaks soothing words to their heart, what do you say that was of such great comfort? So Rashi, quoting the Medrash, speculates upon what Yosef might have said. And here's what he says, Rashi. Rashi says, what are you guys worried about, that I'll kill you? He says, nah. Let me explain to you why I'm not going to kill you. Because until you guys came here to Egypt, okay, everyone thought that I was a little servant kid from the other side of the river that all of a sudden was nouveau rich and made it to the palace and everything. But everyone called me Hayumarana Nalaisan, that everyone called me a little servant kid. But Agidechem, when you guys came, Nodashani Ben Chorin, then everyone realized that really I come from a good upstanding family. I'm not a servant. I have you guys, my brothers. And that, put to rest all of this talk that I was a servant. What do you think now? Ani Horegetchem. You think I'm gonna kill you now? If I killed you, what would people say? People would say that I was never really related to you guys. I saw a bunch of guys. I said, hey guys, pretend you're my brothers. And when I had no more use for them, I got rid of you guys. No one would believe that you're really my brothers because Yesh Lecha Ach Shehoreg Et Achav. Is there such thing as one brother that would try to kill his other brothers? No one would understand our family. Now, here are the brothers. How much comfort is this? This is what Rashi says, the comforting words. Why is Rashi saying this? Where is this Medrash coming from? I don't think this Medrash meant that literally Yosef said this. The Medrash means, I think, that the subconscious of the text, Yosef thinks he forgave them. Yosef thinks he let go. But when you never have reconciliation, when you never say, I forgive, when there's never an apology, right? Look what happened. The brothers hid behind their father. And Yosef, in response, said, it's not up to me. It's up to God. But who is it really up to? Who is it up to forgive? Is Yosef right that it's up to God? No. Right? The Gemara says, the Rambam says, that who is it up to? It's up to the person who is wrong. It is his job to forgive, not God. The brothers are hiding behind their father, and Yosef is hiding behind his father in heaven. Everyone's hiding behind Dad. And somehow reconciliation never happens. And when that never happens, then somehow it's not over. So the question is, what does God think of all of this?
What does God say? We know what the brothers say. We know what Yosef said. What did God say? There's an interesting thing. Where does this take place? This takes place at the end of Vayechi. What did the brothers say? The brothers tried to apologize, but it didn't quite work, so they said, let us be your slaves. What was Yosef's response to let us be your slaves? Not up to me, up to God. May not have been true, but it's what Yosef said. When Yosef said, not up to me, up to God, what did God say? We're at the very end of Vayechi. Turn the page and you're in Shmos. What did God say? We can do slavery. Slavery's on the table. We have an aggrieved guy. He's not really a full-throw apology. He's not really saying, I'm sorry. He says, it's up to me. Did anyone call my name? It's like, you know, I didn't think I was involved, but if, like, I'm involved, there's offer of slavery on the table, we can do slavery. Not only can we do slavery, but look how. You know what Yosef had said? Yosef had said, look at the hashgacha. The hashgacha is the reason why God did this is so I could care for you. What part of hashgacha does Yosef not see?
Slavery.
That this is the first step towards slavery. Turn the page and they're slaves. He doesn't see that. And you know why? Remember the Paro who forgot Yosef? The Paro who forgot Yosef. What is his point of paranoia? Why is he so worried that the Jews are so numerous? How did the Jews get numerous?
Because of Yosef.
Because Yosef provided for them during times of famine, allowing them to have so many children. Remember what Yosef had said? Look at the hashgacha. God allowed me to provide for you. For sure he thinks it's okay. Lachayot Amrav, so that I can make you into an Amrav. Amrav. Who says those words next? Paro says those words. It's another reference to Yosef. Hine Am, B'nai Yisrael, Rav Ba'atsum Nimenu. Look how numerous they are. God says, you know what? Not only will they be slaves, not only will I take you up on that, but you say it's Ashkacha, and it was there so that we could take an Amrav. Yeah, we'll use the Amrav too. How are they going to be slaves? They'll be slaves to the very thing you're talking about, that you made them into an Amrav. That's how they end up becoming slaves, and that's how they do become slaves. But I want to leave you with this, and I've kept you long enough. I'm going to conclude, and then I'm not going to have an open question time. I'll let people go, but you can come around, and I'll answer questions one by one. But what I want to say is this. I think what this provides in is, again, going back to the beginning, is it possible to reconcile? The answer is absolutely yes. It's possible, but it's extremely hard. And in real life, it's very, very hard to do. It is so easy to not quite apologize. It is so easy to think that you've forgiven, but not really forgiven, to never really say those words, to dance around this. It's easy to do it with your spouse. It's easy to do it with your kids. It's especially easy to do this from the family, to smile and make pretend and to feel like everything's fine. And even yourself, you feel everything's fine, but everything's not quite fine. And the worst kind of fight, the worst kind of feud, are family feuds. The family feuds are the ones that don't die easy, right? If the Jews at some level went down into Egypt because of an unresolved feud, look at the impact in Jewish history, not just Egypt, but look at the division in kingdom, the division between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom that expresses itself in the B'nai Yosef, the B'nai Rachel, the B'nai Leah, that never gets resolved centuries later, and the animosity between the house of Saul and the house of David that never gets resolved. Centuries later, the Jews are always struggling with this rift in the family. How would it have been different if this conversation at the end of Vayechi had done things differently? In your own families, I would ask you to consider this, right? You are not just you, right? Do a family tree. That one you becomes many yous, becomes many, many hundreds and many, many thousands of people. And the decisions that we make in our family, between husband and wife, between parent and child, between brothers and sisters, have ramifications for generations. People remember these things. So it's difficult to reconcile, but look how important it is, and look at the significance of what happens when you almost try to do it, but not quite, and especially when you say, it's not up to me, it's up to God. Let God be the judge. Never say, let God be the judge. If you're the judge, take care of it yourself. Don't leave it in God's hands, because that's a really scary thing. So I will leave you with that thought. I will wish you a good night, and you're welcome to stick around and I'll see you.
Amara will be upstairs in about 2-3 minutes.
No, I have to get back. Actually, what time is it?
Now it's about 10:10.
Okay. Fine. So let me ask you this. Can you help me get either a cab or a car for this to here?
I can drive you.
I need to go out. I need to get all the information.
I can drive you
around the presentation.
No problem.
I'll meet you there. I'll catch you after.
Wasn't it mentioned to Abraham that they were going to be
I'm not saying they wouldn't.